Building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host today, Michael Nagler. Our brilliant host, Stephanie Van Hook, is on meditation retreat today, probably becoming even more brilliant. And so I will be taking the show to you. You are hearing this on Friday, July 22nd, if you're listening live, and we are broadcasting from our home station. We have received a lot of comments and calls from friends who are very distressed by the rising tide of violence in the country, in particular the shooting of five police officers in Dallas has led to a lot of people coming to us and asking for some commentary. So we're going to do two things. Right now, we're going to play for you a recording of the talk that I gave at the Vedanta Society in Olima back on Memorial Day. There were 800 people there, and a lot of people have told us that it was a very inspiring and upbeat talk, where I compared Mahatma Gandhi to Swami Vivekananda. And the topic of my talk was Gandhi as a spiritual force. We also have another op-ed that's come out on the topic of the gun violence, and that will be on our website. And 2 days ago, we recorded a conference call on that subject with some friends. So let me go right now to the talk and then come back on when it's over with a little bit of the exciting news that is happening around the world today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Swamiji, and it's a great joy to see all of you here. I will try not to add too much hot air to the air that is already in this tent. I would like to start off by telling you an episode that you may not be familiar with. Back in April, two young men, Derek Oakley and Andres Gutierrez, were in a United Nations refugee camp in South Sudan, in the Boer state. And suddenly that camp was attacked by a militia armed with everything from sharpened sticks to axes to AK-47s. And these two young men ducked into a little hut to protect themselves and found a group of women and children cowering there. Within a few minutes, the militiamen had burst in. They were startled to see the non-Sudanese there, and they ordered them out. But Derek and Andreas were very well trained. They glanced at one another. They simply took out their badges and showed the men and said, "I'm sorry, we are international protection officers, and we're not leaving." The militia turned and left. That happened two more times. In the 20 minutes that this attack lasted, I'm sorry to say 60 people were killed. But no one in that hut was injured because of these two men. Now, what were they doing there? They were there because of Mahatma Gandhi. Because at the very end of his life, he had created an institution, one of many that he and Vinoba Bhave created, over 1,000 of which are still functioning in India. He created an institution called the Shanti Sena, or the Peace Army, which is still functioning. Unfortunately, he was scheduled to give a good meeting, a big meeting on the Shanti Sena concept the day after he fell to an assassin's bullet at the Birla House in Delhi. So the idea went dormant for a little while, but then it was picked up, and some 20 organizations worldwide are now doing what he called for, and they're calling it unarmed civilian peacekeeping. And I'm happy to say that the organization that Derek and Andreas work for, Nonviolent Peace Force, has just received a grant of nearly $9 million from the Dutch government to carry out protection of women and children in South Sudan. So this has become a worldwide institution. Years and years ago, when I was associated with it, I went around saying that this institution is going to be an alternative to war. Even my colleagues didn't believe me at that time, but I think I was right. Now, to talk about this topic, Gandhi as a spiritual force, is not very easy, especially for someone who grew up in Brooklyn. And I was remembering as I crossed Vivekananda Bridge this morning that Sir Richard Attenborough was doing his great film on Gandhi, he got a lot of advice from people what should be in that film, including from me, which he wisely ignored. But one of the people who wrote to him, an Indian, said, and this was in the days when Peter Pan movie was very common, this person said, you know, Gandhi was far too great to be represented as a mere human being. He should be just a disembodied voice, an ashariri vach. And Richard Attenborough did not take kindly to the idea. In fact, he said, I'm not going to portray Gandhi as some kind of blasted Tinkerbell. But the question still remains, what is a spiritual force? And I think we can understand it on two levels. One, there is something that we perceive cognitively, that we learn from, and that we imitate because it appeals to us. And as a matter of fact, since Gandhi's day, in the last 30 years or so, there's been a tremendous explosion of activity in the field of nonviolence. I don't know if you're aware that probably more than two-thirds of the world's countries have by now experienced a major nonviolent uprising of some kind. Not only that, but there are many qualitative changes. If you had only been with me in Berkeley when we were starting the Peace and Conflict Studies program, you'd realize what a revolution it is that there are actually political scientists now who are studying nonviolence. They laughed me out of countenance when I started that thing. But there's a terrific book called Why Civil Resistance Works, which has now shown that if you compare nonviolent with violent uprisings, the nonviolent ones are twice as effective in one-third the time, far less costly in terms of life and treasure. And here's the surprising part to everyone who's not familiar with nonviolent logic, that they lead to greater human freedoms even when they fail, quote unquote, than violent ones do when they succeed. So there is this obvious, just you see something, it works, you use it. And now one of the professors who wrote that book, Erica Chenoweth, told us in an interview on our radio program recently that nonviolence has become the technique du jour, that more people gravitate to it than to violence. Now we have changed that balance recently, all due to the influence of one man who weighed a little bit less than I do and had fewer teeth, Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi said, spiritual force is like any other force that's available to human beings. Now, I feel very unworthy, I must tell you, to be speaking about this, but I do have one qualification, which was that in about 1945, the person who was to become my spiritual teacher, Sri Eknath Ishwaran, a professor at that time, many of us go through that phase, he was teaching at the University of Nagpur, not very far from Gandhiji's ashram, and he went there to visit him, he had a kind of question in the back of his mind, what is the secret of this man's power? And it was just at prayer meeting time. Mahadev Desai was reading out the last 18 verses of the Bhagavad Gita, what is the illumined man, and what he saw, what Ishwaran saw, astounded him. He said he felt as though 2,500 years had melted away and he was seeing the Buddha seated before him. I have actually gone on a pilgrimage to that very tree where Gandhiji was conducting the prayer meeting, and Ishwaran had this experience. Now, the interesting thing was that Ishwaran's takeaway from that episode, from that encounter, was much more like the power moment of the Upanishads, where a spiritually vulnerable seeker like myself meets an illumined sage, much more like that than a political encounter. In fact, Sri Ishwaran never became a satyagrahi. He did not join the freedom struggle, though he was totally in favor of it, inspired by it. For him, Gandhi's meaning was that he was showing us that our civilization could still produce a human being of that character. And he, Ishwaran, went on to write Gandhi the Man, and then came to California, where I met him in 1966. So one level of spiritual force, we're getting into the second level now, is of a direct, rather mysterious communication that takes place from Atman to Atman, soul to soul, even as Swami Vedananda was saying earlier, below the level of mind. And there's a famous mantra in the Katupanishad describing the self. It says, Asino duram vrajati, shayano yati sarvashaha. I won't quote the rest of that mantra because I don't understand it. But this much is very clear, that one who has realized the self, even seated in a particular place, exerts an influence far away. Though still, though lying still, he or she moves everything everywhere. And the Isha Upanishad also says the same thing. Though still, it moves everything everywhere. So this is rather clear, and it's perfectly real, and it takes place even today. A Gandhian was visiting the ashram of Ramana Maharshi in Tiruvannamalai in near Chennai, and well, it's not too near actually, but it's in Tamil Nadu. And this was frequently the case that for a break, you know, ordinary human beings like us working with Gandhi needed a break every now and then. Gandhi did not. You know, 15 hours a day for 50 years was not a problem for him. But they would need a break. They sometimes went to Tiruvannamalai to be with Ramana Maharshi. As he was leaving, the Maharshi said to him, I hope you've had a good visit. And he said, it's been wonderful, but the Bhagavan could see that there was something bothering him. So he said, you have a question. And somewhat hesitantly, this young satyagrahi said, you know, Bhagavan, it's been just wonderful here, but you know, there's so much turmoil in the world, and look what's going on. Gandhi is challenging the British Empire. How can you just sit there? And he quietly, very quietly, quite unruffled, as you can imagine, he said, what makes you think I'm just sitting here? So the young man said, oh, yes, you know, what a fool I am. Ha, ha, ha. But he had no idea what Ramana Maharshi. Years later, as it happened, now, this is a story that you also may not know. Dozens and dozens of Indian satyagrahis came to the civil rights movement, and many, many civil rights activists went to India. So he came to the South, and he was at one point invited to the apartment of one of the big activists, and he was walked into his apartment, and there, to his utter astonishment, was a picture of Ramana Maharshi on this man's dresser, who was unknown in this country at that time. Well, for that matter, he's still unknown to most of us. But instantly, this young man understood that he was having some kind of tremendous spiritual influence, even by not being active. Now, I have a theory. This is what professors do. They have theories. I have a theory that the four ashramas in traditional Hindu society actually reflect this reality, that in the first stage of life, you're a learner, brahmachari, and then you help society by creating its physical institutions. You get married, have a family, you know, participate in society in that way. In the third stage, parivrajaka, you are a renunciate, but you're visible. You know, you go from place to place, maybe begging for alms. People can see your gerua cloth, and they know that it's possible for a human being to renounce, and they're very inspired by that. In the last stage, vanaprastha, you're not even visible. You're living somewhere in the forest, and yet, as the Upanishads say, you are influencing the world from there. A Venezuelan psychiatrist by the name of Caicedo was a very remarkable, kind of delightfully naive person who went to India, and he said, I want to visit all the big yogis, you know. None of this small fry stuff. Waste my time. Take me to the big yogis. So they took him to the Radhaswami of Beas, who had 50,000 followers, and he interviewed him, and guess what? At the end, same old, same old. He said, how can you just sit there? You people are just wasting your time. You're not doing anything. And the Radhaswami said, this is characteristic of them. I would have been outraged. But he said, you know, you're right. What you should do, get this big gunny sack, you know, and go. You're going around India visiting all of us. Put us all in that gunny sack and throw it into the Indian Ocean. And then he quietly added, and see what happens to the world. So this subtle influence, we now live in a time when science has actually developed techniques to understand, to detect this influence. There was a very remarkable scientist by the name of Grinberg Zilberbaum in Mexico who conducted an experiment where you had two people meditating side by side, and then they go into separate rooms, and one of them is shown a flashing light, and they have equipment now so they can see what part of the brain is being activated, and you can see it's going flash, flash, flash. And they put this equipment also on the other person who's in a different room, who's not seeing the light, and guess what? His or her brain is doing exactly the same thing. So they took the second person and moved him to a different building. No problem. They took the first person and put him in what's called a Faraday chamber. This is a lead-lined room through which no electromagnetic vibration can be transmitted. So cell phones don't work in this place. It would be terrifying to be in a room like that for more than 20 minutes. And guess what? It had absolutely no effect on the experimental results. So there is some kind of communication between living beings which reflects the communication that's known as quantum entanglement on the quantum level. It shows that what Einstein called and hated spooky actions at a distance are actually taking place. So that's just ordinary people who are meditating for 20 minutes. In fact, what I know about meditation tells me I bet they weren't even meditating very well. If they were, I don't want to hear about it. But they had this communication going on, which we're not normally aware of. What is the difference between a person like that and a Mahatma? Well, Raihana Tyabji, who is the daughter of Abbas Tyabji, one of a follower of Gandhi's, who originally had been a complete loyalist, but after the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, he became a satyagrahi. And Gandhi actually put him in charge to be second in command after he was arrested at the salt raid in 1930. Anyway, his daughter Raihana, who was a very devout Muslim, modest girl, hardly ever seen in public, said, you could not believe what we were doing under Gandhi's influence. And she said, I have now come to realize more and more to what heights of greatness Bapu has reached. He said that his consciousness was able to take hold of our consciousness and take it to a place which was unimaginable. Absolutely. How we got through those years, I will never understand. Now, my own teacher, as I say, was not political, that he left that to me. He had his own testimony. He said, when Gandhiji was fasting, I would sit down at the table, fully intending to do full justice to my idlis and doshas, and found that I couldn't eat. Gandhi fasting, he and several thousand other people were not able to even eat. India as a whole recognized Gandhi for what he was. Now, just imagine, if you could take this spiritual influence that I've referred to, however inadequately, and so there you, just by being seated in a deep state of meditation, you can influence others, you can influence the world. Imagine if you decided to go out and influence the world actively as well without sacrificing that spiritual groundedness, and you have, well, I would say, watch out. Because there you have Gandhi working for 50 years, 7 days a week, 15 hours a day. Two secretaries were driven practically to exhaustion by his activities. One of them wrote a little ditty that went, "To live with a saint in heaven is a matter of bliss and glory. To live with one on earth is quite another story." Now, with all of this, with all this impact that you have on individuals, I also want to stress the tremendous impact that Gandhiji has had on history. After all, I would not be here talking with you today. You would not be here listening to me if it weren't for him. Quite apart from liberating India, which everybody thinks was his greatest accomplishment, he actually said, "I'm using India. I am using India as an ocular demonstration of the power of soul force, the power of himself." And when you stop to think about it, he leaves for South Africa to confront colonialism in 1893. Have you heard that year mentioned here earlier today? 1 month after he goes to South Africa, Swamiji comes to Chicago. You know, Gandhi used to say that reality is a coin with two faces, truth on one side, nonviolence on another. I can easily imagine in some loka, Gandhiji and Vivekananda tossing that coin, and Gandhiji saying, "Oh gosh, Naren, I'm sorry. All I have to do is take down the British Empire. You have to try to bring Vedanta to America." And Naren, thank you. And Naren saying, "Well, I tell you what, I'll start a little park in California, and we can be talking about you in 130 years. So quite apart from ending a world order, which we might call colonialism 101 or 1.0, where something like 60 countries achieved their freedom in the wake of that event. Even if that were not big enough, I think the spiritual influence of Gandhi has been even greater. This was, if you think of 1893, remember, it'll just be in 2 years, December of 1985, when two cataclysmic events will happen in the West. One, Wilhelm Röntgen will give a paper which will lead to the atomic age, the discovery of what he called X-Strahlungen, X-rays. And another, which I think is even more important, that two brothers, who are called the Lumière brothers, it's hard to believe that was really their name, but they for the first time showed a commercial film in Paris. So the age of mass media and the atomic age began on the same day, and that was only 2 years after these two giant figures fanned out into the West to bring the ancient perennial philosophy to a country and a civilization that needed it very badly. Go only 5 years down the line is the discovery of quantum reality. And Dr. Raja Ramana, who was the chair of the Department of Energy in India, said, "It is only the Vedanta which seems to be in a position to absorb the tremendous impact of the new science." So there's something cosmic happening here also. And let me just read you a quote from Jitatmananda in his book Holistic Science and Vedanta. He said, "What we recognize as the material universe, the universe of space and time, and elementary particles and energies, is the materialization of a primal mind. In that sense, there is no waiting for consciousness to arise. It is there always. What we wait for in the evolution of life is only the culminating event, the emergence of creatures that in their self-awareness can articulate consciousness and give it a voice." And I would say we are now at an intermediate stage where a few, like Gandhiji, have carried that process to its ultimate conclusion and thus delivered this tremendous impact to the world. It was one of his opponents, Sir Stafford Cripps, you may remember him from the history of the Satyagraha movement, who said that Gandhi was the greatest Indian since Buddha and the greatest man since Jesus Christ. And now we have a language to possibly understand the central teachings of the Vedanta in terms that we are familiar with, most of us are, in the scientific West. And that can lead, I think, to a tremendous breakthrough. But I also think that that breakthrough will not happen without the final discovery that Gandhi made and delivered to the world, which is the breakthrough of nonviolence. Nonviolence is as native to the new image of reality that we are trying to reach as violence is to the world that we live in today. I might remind you with some diffidence, some sorrow, that last year, 385 days had massive shootings of four or more people wounded or injured in our country. So that's almost a massacre per day in this highly technological culture. So, but science, as I say, has now begun to discuss, has begun to detect this spiritual force and discuss it in their literature. And I think this could be a tremendous breakthrough. But even if we succeed in creating the new story, I don't think that it's going to happen by itself. I think it's going to need nonviolence to make it take place. One of the characteristics of this force that the Upanishads referred to and which Gandhiji embodied is that it cannot be limited in space or time. Now, the question sometimes comes up for someone who works in my field, did Gandhi meditate? And the short answer is yes. There's a photograph of him in meditation. This is what Ishwanji saw when he visited him at his ashram. But you know perfectly well that a professor is not going to rest content with a short answer. So a similar question was asked once of Neem Karoli Baba. His disciples asked, did Jesus meditate, or how did Jesus meditate? And I just want to read you his answer because it's so inspiring and it matches so perfectly what Gandhi was about. "It seemed as if Maharajji," that's what they called Neem Karoli Baba, "was about to answer. But instead, his eyes closed and he sat there completely still, completely silent. It felt like he had totally disappeared. In all the time I'd been with him, I'd only seen him sitting motionless like this a couple of times before. It was extraordinarily powerful, as if the whole universe had become silent. Then a tear came down his cheek. We were in awe. After a couple of minutes, his eyes half opened, and with great emotion, he quietly said, He lost himself in love. That's how he meditated. He was one with all beings. He loved everyone, even the people who crucified him. And he went on to say, he never died. He is the Atman, the soul who lives in the hearts of all. Now, if the core of our problems is violence, then this spiritual force, call it love, call it nonviolence, is the answer to all of them. And as a matter of fact, the most important sentence that I ever heard was something that was quietly uttered by my spiritual teacher. He only uttered things quietly, so this is a little bit superfluous to say this. I'm sure that he was talking to me, but he pretended not to be. You're just walking by. We've been talking about Gandhi. I think the Attenborough film had just come out. And he said, that man came back from South Africa having realized God and quietly set about solving every problem in the modern world. So this is another characteristic of a spiritual force, that you can aim at the core of a problem and not get, as we call it today, siloed and caught up in shall I save the whales or stop the nukes or whatever shall I do. If you change human consciousness, it will change everything. As Vandana Shiva said, if you get rid of the pollution in the human mind, they will get rid of the pollution in the environment. Another great scientist, Albert St. George, said this about Gandhi to give us a sense of that tremendous change that he potentially is bringing about to a new world order. Because Gandhiji was aware from his earliest days in South Africa that this was not a racial struggle. It was not a struggle of one community against another. It was a clash of civilizations, if you wanted to call it that. But it was a clash of core narratives, the clash between a story of materialism, which had been in place in this country for so many years in this civilization, and a story of spirituality. And so St. George, who's a Nobel Prize winner, said this: between the two world wars, at the heyday of colonialism, force reigned supreme. It had a suggestive power, and it was natural for the weak to lie down before the stronger. Now, let me just interrupt this quote for a second and remind you of something that the great British historian Arnold Toynbee said about Gandhi. He said, he made it impossible for us to go on ruling India, but he made it possible for us to leave without rancor and without humiliation. That is the core secret of what he had discovered. So, it was natural for the weaker to lie down before the stronger. Then came Gandhi, chasing out of his country, almost single-handed, the greatest military power on earth. He taught the world that there are higher things than force, higher even than life itself. He proved that force had lost its suggestive power. Now, in the Gandhi film, when Attenborough was filming it, I'm sure almost all of you have seen that film. One of the climactic scenes is the funeral cortege in which Gandhi's body is taken, ironically, on a gun carriage. It's being taken to his funeral pyre. And if you're going to do a film in India, you need hundreds of thousands of extras, right? So you hear this huge crowd getting a couple of rupees, I guess, to stand there and watch the procession go by. And when it was being acted at the end of the scene, I guess Attenborough said, cut. I think they still say that. I'm not sure. And Ben Kingsley, the actor, got up. And suddenly that entire crowd fell into a stunned silence because you could tell what was going through their mind. They were thinking, what if he came back? So the final question for us, I think, is how do we, knowing that we are capable of this spiritual force, how do we develop it in our own life? And at our nonprofit, the Meta Center, we've come up with a simple routine of five things that everybody can do. It's approximately the most difficult thing you could possibly do in your life. But the first one usually makes us so unpopular that we don't get down the rest of the list. But I have a feeling that with this audience, I might get a little further. The first one is don't watch television. You know, stop, thank you, yeah. I haven't noticed a single flat screen TV the whole time I've been here. So, of course, when you stop, and what we really mean is to use utmost discretion in exposing yourself to all forms of mass media. They have only one purpose, and that is to keep us buried down in that old story of materialism, separateness, violence. How many of you read in the New York Times or saw on CNN the story of Derek Oakley and Andres Gutierrez? Nada. But I bet many of you read the story about three Americans who jumped on a guy with a rifle on a train in Paris because he used weapons. They used force. So we can understand this. So point number one, don't expose yourself to that stuff. This will, of course, create a big vacuum in your mind. You're going to need to fill it somehow. What we recommend in all humility is to learn everything that you can about nonviolence. You will find that it's a vast subject, and we hope that the Meta Center can be of help to you in that regard. The only thing you need to know about the Meta Center is that it's two T's. So METTACENTER.org. Thirdly, do take up some spiritual practice, whether it be, you know, passage meditation, or we do some other form of meditation. Even if you stop taking in all the violent imagery that's part of our civilization, it's been there for a while already, and we're going to need to purify it. We're going to need to get it out there, get out of there. So meditation or some other form of spiritual practice, and I'm sure the Swamis can help you with that also. Then fourth, remember here that Martin Luther King said we must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented civilization to a person-oriented civilization. We will never discover the Atman in a machine. They ain't got one. You know, machines can be only as clever as human consciousness has made them, and we must relate to one another personally, overcome our difficulties with one another in order to make any spiritual progress. One of the studies where families were asked to stop watching television, so it's not just us, the families reported that after they stopped watching television, they had a lot of fights. Because they had all of these tensions which they hadn't bothered to work out because they just sat and watched television instead. But once they got over the fights, they discovered each other as human beings. Every Tuesday when I was still teaching at Berkeley, every Tuesday I'd be driving up to Petaluma for our evening meditation class, go through the Richmond Bridge toll plaza with a friend named George. And when George went to give his $2 or whatever it was in those days to the lady usually at the counter, he would say, how are you? You know, my name is George. How are you doing? And I'm sitting there saying, let's get out of here. You know, come on, we're going to be late. This is usually my fault. And one day I suddenly realized that George was right. So every time you have an opportunity, take a friend out for a decaf latte, something like that, instead of sending them a quick email. And just try to relate more personally to one another, and then you will be very well positioned to take up some form of social service. And the last thing that we would recommend is that when you're doing that, familiarize yourself with what we're calling the new story, the story of a spiritually based universe, which in some ways has been with us for thousands and thousands of years. Yoga Vasishta is nothing but the new story over and over again. I love that text because, you know, I read a paragraph and I learn that the outside world is not real. I say, isn't that wonderful? And then I forget. And so the next paragraph says it again. and so on, on and on. We strongly recommend that you familiarize yourself with this entire paradigm so that when people ask you, or if you really have a lot of chutzpah, even if they don't ask you, you go up and say, you know, we need to save the whales because all life is one interconnected whole, because we have mirror neurons that reflect the pain of others, and it is impossible to hurt another creature without registering that pain ourselves, and so on and so forth. Thank you so very much for your attention. It's been an absolute delight speaking with you, and I hope to see you again.
Here we are again, KWMR, Peace Paradigm Radio, and a few minutes now on Nonviolence in the News, where we bring you events and analysis that you will not usually get in the mainstream. And as usually, we are going to do a couple of resources and then go into the news. I want to particularly focus on what's starting tomorrow in Philadelphia. So as for resources, the organization Pace e Bene has a new website dedicated to Christian nonviolence and pacifism. You'll find the Pace e Bene reports on the Vatican conference recently passed that we did do a program about. And also there's a new website, peaceablerevolution.org, which deals with Christian nonviolence and pacifism. I'd like also to mention a book called Let Them Stay, U.S. War Resisters in Canada, 2004 to 2016. I know I had mentioned it once before, but the fact is that my brother is one of those people, and so I'm just getting to mention it again. That book by Sarah Hipworth and Luke Stewart, Let Them Stay. There are a lot of events heating up around the world around the issue of nuclear disarmament, and it's quite a face-off. A large number of states which do not have nuclear weapons are calling for a complete ban of these weapons, and states that possess them, of course, are digging in and saying they won't. So you can stay connected with all of this on a new website, which is www.unfoldzero.org. That's unfoldzero.org. Now, on to the news. Tomorrow, July 23rd, in Philadelphia, there is a dual event taking place. The official event, as you are probably aware, is the Democratic National Convention, the DNC. But we at Peace Paradigm Radio are particularly interested in a very large groundswell, a grassroots movement, which is trying to turn the Bernie Sanders candidacy into a revolution. And in fact, there is a website called peoplesrevolution.org, where you will hear from a young fellow by the name of Jack Rabbit. And they are now renting space at the Arch Street Meeting House. Philadelphia, as you know, is a home of Quakerism in the U.S. So Arch Street Meeting House will be designated for organizing workshops. And Move to Amend and Popular Resistance are two of the first groups that have signed on to host a workshop in this space. Now, Meta is doing two things about this, what we really hope will be a watershed event. For one, we have already put on and recorded a webinar with Kazu Haga of East Point Academy. That's East Point Peace Academy, counterbalancing the West Point War Academy. West Point is on the East Coast, so of course East Point is here on the left coast. And we have put on these webinars to train people, give them at least some basic starting instructions on peace teams, how to deal with conflict situations, whether it's coming up for ourselves or as a third party. Now, moving on from there, but I really expect that we'll be able to give you a much more detailed report in our next program. The BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, has picked up some speed recently from the United Church of Christ, and I'd like to read you a little bit of their statement. Here they go. As a church, we have a right to engage in nonviolent action to bring about change, including using economic leverage. All people and organizations have that right, and it is a right we must defend. For this reason, with the full support of the Board of Directors of the New York Conference of the United Church of Christ, we respectfully request that the New York Conference, United Church of Christ, be placed on the top of the state's list of organizations for the New York State, for the state of New York to boycott. Governor Cuomo, stop denying our rights. Rescind your executive order now. This is one of a number of kickbacks that we've experienced against the BDS campaign on campuses and now from the state of New York, attempting to make the call for such a boycott illegal, which would be a serious infringement of our constitutional rights, according to the United Church of Christ. Well, in contrast to the kind of news that we usually get from Israel-Palestine, I just wanted to mention a conflict resolution group, but also a constructive program type of group called Gun-Free Kitchen Tables. This is a coalition of 13 Israeli human rights groups. And Gun-Free Kitchen Tables has introduced a formerly non-existent feminist analysis of human security, militarization, and a critique of the equation of guns with security and in the Israeli discourse. They had difficulty when they because of the recent stabbings that began a few months ago, even though no security guard off duty has ever done anything to stop it. So possession of guns by Israeli citizens would not really be relevant to those attacks. Code Pink, meanwhile, has called for an investigation into possible war crimes in response to the civilian death toll from government drone attacks. This is from a president, mind you, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. He has seriously escalated the number of these attacks, issued a report with what many people think is an underestimated number of civilian casualties. Now, I may have mentioned this in our last program. In that case, I think it bears repetition. There was a young man named Michael Haas who was a drone pilot, I guess, or operator, I guess they call them. And he refers to the existential sensation of killing someone by manipulating a computer joystick. And he said it has left a deep and lasting impression on him. You are made to think of the targets as just black blobs on a screen. So you start to do these psychological gymnastics, he says, to make it easier to do what you have to do. They deserved it. They chose which side to be on. You had to kill. This is the key point of his conversation. You had to kill part of your conscience to keep doing your job every day. And you had to ignore those voices telling you this wasn't right. And Michael has a lot to say about euphemisms, the way that these killings are referred to as cutting the grass, and things like that. And you may remember in Hannah Arendt's book on Adolf Eichmann, she quoted Eichmann as saying in response to a question, how were you able to do this atrocity of killing so many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people? And Eichmann said, our language made it possible. Because euphemism is a step back from reality. Killing people by drones is another step back, further back from reality. And it is a very dangerous thing to do in the game of violence and nonviolence. The only way that we're going to overcome our violent habits and our violent culture is by facing them for what they are. So I want to end on a more upbeat note, this time from Budapest, Hungary, there is this is because this is becoming a kind of repetitive meme in popular nonviolent resistance. You remember we talked before about a park in Ankara, Turkey. Well, the same thing is happening here on a park called the Liget in Budapest. This park is being, there were plans anyway to cut down all the trees, bulldoze it, and make it into some kind of shopping mall or high-rise apartments. And protesters are stopping that from happening. And one of their statements is, the movement is a little seed. We are planting it, and I hope we will grow into a big, colorful, lovely planet, not just for Hungarians, but for all people on the planet to harvest, smell, and taste its fruits. This was on waging nonviolence. And I think it raises an extremely interesting and critical issue for us. We know, since reading Paul Hawkins' book or hearing his lectures, the book was called Blessed Unrest, that there are literally millions of organizations doing wonderful little things like this all over the planet. How and by what process do they come together and form an unstoppable movement? So it's exactly in this connection that Meta will be offering something else in Philadelphia starting tomorrow, and that is workshops on our roadmap project, which is designed to help people create a long-term strategy. It also talks about personal empowerment and training, but it will, I hope, provide a tool so that people who were inspired by the Bernie candidacy and know that the time is now to start a long-term strategy for revolutionary and deep change will be able to come to the Meta workshops and get materials to do that. The information will be on our website. So, friends, let me leave you with that. And as Stephanie Van Hook would say, until next time, take care of one another. Thank you.